Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I am delighted and indeed honoured to welcome to the programme Professor Thomas Seyfried, who is Professor of Biology at Boston College, Massachusetts in the US. In 2012, Professor Seyfried published the groundbreaking work entitled Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. After a PhD from the University of Illinois and a postdoc fellowship at Yale University in neurology, he has enjoyed a long and distinguished career researching in areas such as gene-environmental interactions, lipid biochemistry, neurodegeneration, epilepsy, cancer, metabolism, brain tumors, autism, ketogenic diets, amongst many, many other things. In addition to numerous lifetime achievement awards for his work, he's also on the board of several academic journals. Professor Seyfried, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Thank you, Julian. It's a real pleasure to be here.
It's fantastic to have you on. As I say, a privilege to be speaking with you. Now, before we do get on to the conversation, I always like to make an important note. Always do this with these sort of medical type conversations. So please, anybody listening, please do note nothing in this conversation should be understood as personal medical advice because everybody's different. All of this is for information purposes only. Please do consult your doctor first before making any changes to your diet or your lifestyle or medications or indeed any changes as a consequence of what you've heard here today on this program. So, Professor Seyfried, you have been working in this area of cancer research for some decades now. Only recently come across your work. It's absolutely fascinating. And over that time, we've gone from a situation, say, back in the 1990s, where it was said that something like one in three of us will maybe develop cancer or probably develop cancer at some point in our lives, to a situation now where I'm hearing people saying things like, well, it's more like one in two of us. So obviously something is going drastically wrong, and it seems to me that we're not fundamentally changing. So what's going wrong in your view?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, I think a number of things are going wrong. Mm. Whenever you have a situation, like you've just mentioned, something is increasing when hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent in an attempt to manage cancer, and yet we're getting more cancer. It clearly speaks to something, as you said, that we're doing or not doing. And it comes down to the continuous, you know, Western diet and lifestyle. Mm. But I look at it as both dietary lifestyle issues. In our environments are becoming more, in some ways, polluted. We are not getting as much exercise as we did in the past. We're eating more highly processed foods than we had in the past. And as you can see, the obesity epidemic, at least in our country, is really an epidemic. And all of these are signs that link to chronic diseases, cancer being a primary one, but we also have increases in type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, macular degeneration, hypertension, high blood pressure. Yeah. All of these kinds of disorders are linked in one way or another to rather sharp changes in diets and lifestyles, not to any genetic or predisposition risk factor.
That's very interesting you should say that, because I think a lot of people would think, isn't cancer entirely a genetic matter? No doubt we'll talk about that in due course. It's very interesting that you should say that, because a lot of what you said there connects with what Dr. Paul Marek said on this program to do with metabolic diseases and how those seem to be going up all the time. There's something that we're doing wrong, very definitely. Now, is it true that people from, let's say, non-Western ancestral populations, let's say if they change their lifestyles and they adopt a typical Western diet and lifestyle, that they often start to get these kinds of diseases? Is that true?
Yes, there's a lot of strong information to support that. I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to visit the medical school at Thunder Bay, Canada. It's on Lake Superior. And that medical school services the Inuit group in the Arctic Circle. Apparently, it's not appropriate to use the term Eskimo, but Inuit is the more correct term, I guess you could say. But those folks are really riddled with type 2 diabetes, cancer, heart disease. They were an extremely resilient and healthy population. And those individuals that do maintain their traditional diet and lifestyles do remain fit. Mm. But as soon as they hit the you know, the fried chicken, hamburgers, every other kind of processed food, their physiology is extremely susceptible to rapid change. So within a generation or two, you go from a healthy population into one where, you know, every other person has type 2 diabetes or is obese and has afflicted with all these other chronic diseases, including cancer. As a matter of fact, Julian, I have a paper that came out of England in the 1880s. And what was the predominant? I think it was in Wales. I guess not England, Wales, where they looked at the afflictions of people. And a lot of it was infections and influenza and things like this. Cancer was very minor. And then they looked at the same population today within the last couple of years, and cancer and heart disease and all these kinds of things are skyrocketing. So clearly, any population, whether ancestral populations or people transitioning more and more to a Western diet and lifestyle, seems to carry the baggage of type 2 diabetes, cancer, hypertension, and all these other things to go along with it.
Right. And so this puts to a certain extent the lie to the idea that this is just because people are living longer now. I often hear this, whatever it is, dementia or heart disease, whatever. Oh, we're all living longer now. So, you know, that's the cause of it. There'd be some truth to that, of course, but that's not a complete explanation, is it?
No. A lot of people, for certain, are living longer, but are they living healthier? So we have a longevity, but we also have a healthy life. And a lot of folks are in nursing homes. Yeah, they're living 5 or 10 years longer, but I wouldn't consider them very healthy because we've eliminated a lot of things that would kill us in the past, like infections. That was generally a way to die, was bacterial infections and these kinds of things. And with the advent of more and more solutions and therapies for infection and bacterial infection, viral infection, people survive. But they now are afflicted with all kinds of chronic diseases. You're substituting one problem with another, but you are living longer. But I'm not necessarily sure that that's also linked to healthy longevity.
Right. So there's lifespan, but there's also health span. A lot of people are talking about today, because it's crucially important. Yes, indeed. Now, you've said in a number of presentations that our bodies are actually quite resistant to cancer. At least they should be. You know, if it wasn't for all the toxins, the poor diet, the lack of exercise, etc., too many medications, etc., that actually we're quite resistant. I think that's an astonishing thing to hear, because, as I said before, you know, people tend to think, before hearing you, I tend to think, it's already down to your genes and it's all predetermined, you know. But no, we're actually quite tough cookies to crack in some ways.
Oh, yeah. We evolved over the ice ages, deserts, starvation. The human being is an incredibly resistant animal because we had to survive in the harshest kinds of conditions. We are supremely designed to live without food because in our Paleolithic lithic past, processed carbs were not part of our diet. It was primarily a hunter-gatherer. Hunter, what does that mean, hunting? You had to run after something and kill it and then eat it.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of energy to do that. And you're not going to get too fat eating, you know, the liver from an elk or a bear or whatever you're going to kill. Yeah. You're going to be lean and mean, and you're going to be very buff. The only thing that's going to, a major thing that's going to kill you is an infection from an attack or a fall or a broken bone or something like that. And arthritis too. We've seen, you know, older folks can, in Paleolithic periods, if the diet wasn't completely balanced, arthritis would be a consequence of that. But you're right. I mean, we are pretty healthy folks if we're not beaten down from years and years of a lack of exercise and consumption of highly processed foods with minimal nutritional value.
Yeah, and I suppose fasting would come into that as well, because again, go back to Dr. Marek, who was talking a lot about fasting. But presumably we would be feasting when we found the animal, and that's, yeah, we'd all gather around that and we'd have a good old time, and then it might be some time before we find food again. So I suppose that, again, that's part of the way we're supposed to be, really, and yet we cram our faces full of food all the time, 3 times a day. It's remarkable.
Yeah,
really.
We never, right.
We put up with it.
And you're right about the feast. I mean, to catch a big animal and kill it takes a tremendous amount of energy. And you don't do that like 3 times a day.
No. No.
You know, you have to track down some poor animal. The wife tells you, says, I'm hungry now. Why don't you go out and kill another deer for us? Well, you know, this is not something that we take up readily. You know, let's enjoy it while we have it. When we're hungry enough, we'll go out and do it again.
So obviously, yes, we should learn from the way we were adapted or designed, or however you want to look at that. Indeed. Okay, so your work is challenging the idea to some extent that this is all genetically predetermined, etc. I'm wondering how to go about this. One of the things that you do in one of your lectures is to critique something, and perhaps you'll tell us exactly what this is in a moment, but you critique something called the somatic mutation theory, and you say that it's not up to snuff to try and explain everything, and you show that there are some problems with that theory, and from that then you have your own approach to this. Could you tell us something about that and why you critique that?
Yeah, well, theories in science have led to major changes and advancements in how we think about things. Mm. And I always introduce the heliocentric theory versus the geocentric theory. The heliocentric theory of Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler pretty much solidified that it was the sun that was the center of the solar system, with the Earth revolving around that. Now, of course, that was a major intellectual conceptual advancement, but it wasn't associated with nearly 1,700 people a day dying as the result of not embracing that concept. Mm. Louis Pasteur's germ theory replaced Galen's bad air theory for the understanding of germs linked to disease. So the current view now is that cancer is a genetic disease caused by somatic mutations. These are mutations in the genome that are acquired during the course of one's life. And if you go to the National Cancer Institute of the United States and you go to their website and it says, you know, what is cancer? Cancer is, the definition of cancer is cell division out of control, dysregulated cell growth. And according to the National Cancer Institute and also the NHS in England, they say this dysregulated growth is the result of a collection of somatic mutations that lead to the dysregulated the growth. So the competing theories is that no, the dysregulated growth in the mitochondrial metabolic theory says that it's the organelle, the mitochondrion, that generates energy. And when that organelle becomes defective, it leads to reactive oxygen species. These are like carcinogenic and mutagenic. So according to the real accurate definition is that cancer dysregulation comes from the inability to regulate energy metabolism in the cell, and the mutations, the somatic mutations, are downstream effects rather than the causes of dysregulated growth.
All right. So if we have genetic mutations, whether they happen within our lifetime or perhaps even if they're inherited, they wouldn't necessarily determine that we are going to develop a cancer. They would predispose us. Would that be right?
Well, I think for inherited mutations would be what we call a risk factor. Mm. It's a secondary risk factor, not a primary risk factor. The only way that cancer can occur is when the organelle that generates energy within the cell becomes chronically disrupted and replaced by energy through fermentation, which is energy without oxygen.
Right.
So every cancer cell that we have ever studied can grow in the absence of oxygen. In other words, in hypoxia. One of the great clear indications of this is that you know as well as everyone that if you drink cyanide, it will kill you very, very quickly because we block the ability of our body to get energy from oxygen. So we die fast with cyanide. The cyanide has no effect on the growth of a tumor cell. So tumor cells can live in the presence of cyanide as we and Warburg and others have tested.
Wow.
And clearly this distinguishes the cancer cell very strikingly from a normal cell, because we can't live in the presence of cyanide. We die very quickly because all the energy in our body would be shut off immediately. Mm. The cancer cell does not use energy from oxygen. It uses ancient fermentation pathways, energy without oxygen. And this makes the clear and striking difference between cancer and normal cells.
Wow, this is fascinating. Of course, this goes to the heart of your work. And I'm wondering whether we could sort of collect these ideas around an historic character who I believe was very, very important for you, which is Otto Warburg. Who was a medical doctor, physiologist from the earlier part of the 20th century. Could you pinpoint what it is that he discovered and you know why that is so key for your work?
Yeah, he showed in no uncertain terms in slices of normal tissue and tumor tissue. He used oxygen consumption, which we now know there's a problem with that. But at face value, we're going to look at it as a marker. He found that if you take a slice of a liver or a kidney and look at the consumption of oxygen over time, you find it to be quite steady and high. And if you take a slice of a tumor from a human, a rat, or a mouse, and you compare it exactly to the consumption of a similar human, mouse, or rat tissue, you find that the oxygen consumption of the tumor is always lower in the cancer cell. And not only that, the cancer tissues always excreted large amounts of lactic acid, lactate, and that's a marker for glucose fermentation. So rather than being metabolized for energy completely, the cancer cell takes in the sugar, the glucose, but then wastes a lot of it by dumping out lactic acid, where the normal cells would burn the end product of glycolic, which is pyruvate, and get a lot of energy from this. So normal cells, the waste product in our normal cells is CO2 and water. So every breath that we exhale has moisture and CO2 that we blow back into the atmosphere. The cancer cell produces largely lactic acid. Okay, it will produce some CO2, but it's mostly lactic acid, the waste product. So clearly, Warburg showed in no uncertain terms that all cancers that he studied had lower oxygen consumption and a much greater production of lactic acid in the presence of 100% oxygen. Hmm. So in 100% oxygen, normal cells should produce no lactic acid, but cancer cells continue to produce high amounts of lactic acid. And he attributed that to a failure of some sort in the respiratory capacity of the cell. Right. And he pinpointed that to the organelle called the mitochondrion. He called them grana in those days, but now they're called mitochondria. So he was able to say that all cancers arose from a chronic disruption of their ability to generate energy by the consumption of oxygen, thereby falling back on a fermentation pathway. And I and others have shown that all cells on our planet did the same kind of metabolism before oxygen came into the atmosphere 2.5 billion years ago, produced by cyanobacteria that produced oxygen for the first time. So cancer cells are doing nothing more than falling back on ancient prehistoric metabolic pathways driven by fermentation. Mm. And Albert St. Gyorgy said that was the alpha period of life on Earth, where cells were constantly in a dysregulated growth, dysregulated proliferation. Mm. And they would only stop proliferating when the fermentable fuels in the environment were used up and disappeared, and then these cells would die. So cancer cells are essentially doing the very similar thing. They live on fermentable fuels, the sugar glucose and the amino acid glutamine. And as long as the cancer cells have access to these two fermentable fuels, they will continue to grow.
Right, right.
So it's not a mystery.
Yeah, yeah. So most of these cells then have potentially two main ways of generating energy. And if the mitochondria are dysfunctional, then they will sort of say to themselves, okay, well, we can't generate energy that way anymore. We'll shift back to an ancient way of doing this that doesn't involve oxygen. We'll do it that way. And this is the fermentation process. And you say that that is kind of out of control, and I understand it uses a lot of glucose, and it's not regulated. Can I just check these things through with you then? So most normal cells, I believe it doesn't include red blood cells, so most normal cells, they use this process that you've described called oxidative phosphorylation. So is that that's oxygen plus glucose making energy, making ATP, chemical energy.
Yes.
And that's in the mitochondria. But then if the mitochondria are dysfunctional, it starts to go wrong. So that the cells say to themselves, you know, I'm being poetic here, of course, they say to themselves, whoops, we can't do it that way anymore. We're going to do it in a different way. We're going to ferment. We need even more glucose. We're going to make ourselves even more able to use glucose, and we're not going to involve oxygen. So we'll produce a lot of lactic acid. And this won't be happening in the mitochondria. This will be happening outside the mitochondria in the cell. And there may be a lot of oxygen out there available, but we're not going to do this. We can't do it because our mitochondria are just not working properly. We'll produce energy this way. And that then becomes dysregulated. That becomes out of control. And that's the cancer cell. Have I got that? Is that the basic picture?
Yeah. Julian, you have it pretty well defined. The issue here, of course, is that if that disruption to the energy metabolism of the mitochondria is acute, it will kill, the cell dies, just like I said with cyanide. You disrupt that process acutely. and the cell dies. As Warburg said, you can never get a cancer cell from a dead cell. So the disruption of the oxidative phosphorylation, you're absolutely correct, production of ATP, which is the energy chemical currency in the cell from the consumption of oxygen and full oxidation of the glucose molecule, producing the waste products of CO2 and water, as opposed to the cancer cell that can't fully metabolize the glucose and dumps a lot of it out in the form of lactic acid, even in the presence of oxygen. But the important issue to remember is that this transition from respiration to fermentation is a chronic one rather than an acute one.
Right.
And the cell will do everything possible to attempt to maintain oxidative phosphorylation. But here's the interesting thing. What would cause this to happen in the first place, where a cell would undergo chronic disruption of oxidative phosphorylation? And there's so many, like exposure to carcinogens. Carcinogens will enter the cell and enter into the mitochondria itself and chronically disrupt the ability of the cell to get energy from oxygen. So over time, that cell gradually starts to ferment. Now, the interesting thing is the mitochondria controls the regulation of the cell cycle. So the regulation of the differentiated state, the quiescent state, is under the control of that energy-deriving organelle, the mitochondria. It controls the cell cycle. So it allows cells, like normal cells will grow in our body, but they have regulated growth. They don't have dysregulated growth. So the transition from oxidative phosphorylation to fermentation has to be a gradual chronic one. And interestingly enough, that mitochondria is so sensitive for the presence of oxygen. As soon as something starts to disrupt the ability to generate energy from oxygen, the mitochondria signals the nucleus. It's an epigenetic signaling system. And then the cell all of a sudden starts to produce transporters on the surface of the cell, like you said, to bring in far more glucose because you're not fully metabolizing the glucose. So the mitochondria signals the nucleus to turn on genes that upregulate the transporters to get more glucose into the cell.
Wow.
And also glutamine. So the mitochondria signaled that the cell is suffocating slowly. And this transition from using energy with oxygen to using energy without oxygen is a chronic one. But at the same time, as the mitochondria struggle to maintain energy balance, they are throwing out these radical biomolecules called reactive oxygen species, the radical oxygen molecule, the OH anide radical. These are carcinogenic and mutagenic. So the damage to the nucleus is coming as a secondary downstream effect of the disturbed metabolism in the mitochondria, leading to what we call the somatic mutations. But at the same time, the cell is opening up these transporters to allow it to use a fermentation metabolism. And this happens over time until the cell has lost all of its control. The mitochondria control the apoptotic, the cell death signaling. It controls the quiescent state. It controls the cell cycle. So when the controlling mechanism of the cell becomes corrupted, the cell falls back on these ancient pathways, no growth control any longer, growing out of control. And as long as those fermentable fuels and the transporters are upregulated, these cells are going to survive and they're going to grow.
Yeah.
And so it's just a metabolic transition from one energetic state to the other. But these so-called oncogenes that people say cause cancer. No, oncogenes are simply facilitators of the fermentation condition driven by the abnormal mitochondria. So they're not the drivers of this whole thing. And the reason we know this, because if we take cancer cells and replace bad mitochondria with new mitochondria, the entire fermentation pathways are downregulated and turn off, and the cell enters back into a growth-regulated state. So clearly, those are not the drivers. They're just facilitators of a fermentation metabolism.
Right.
And if you take away, put new mitochondria, everything turns off, and the cell comes back to a normal state, normal growth-regulated state.
Okay, so what you're describing here is actually experimental evidence, is it?
Yes.
Aha.
Experimental evidence.
I see. Yeah.
So the nuclear transfer experiments and mitochondria transfer experiments have all documented this.
Yeah.
So and the nucleus persists with all the damaged chromosomes and mutations, but the cell is now in a growth regulated way. so clearly the nuclear mutations are not the cause of this, they're the effects. They're secondary downstream effects. So a cell can still maintain growth regulation despite having a range of chromosomal and gene mutations.
Right. Does this go back then to, I think in one talk you talk about some research that was done back in, I think in the late 1960s with a tadpole cloned from the nucleus of a frog's kidney tumor cell or something. But it had
That was the work of McKennell. Yeah, McKennell, I had to, before he passed away, I had a great opportunity. He was the curator of the medical library at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Mm. And I had the chance to sit in his office for hours talking about his tadpole nuclear transfer experiments, where he transferred the nucleus of a raging kidney tumor, highly malignant kidney tumor, and put it into an enucleated egg. In frogs, you can do these kinds of experiments, but they were also done in mice much later by Dr. Rudy Janisch down here at MIT. But what McKinnell did was he took a fertilized egg of the frog and replaced that. It's like we clone Dolly the sheep today and do these things, but the early work was done on amphibians and frogs. So McKinnell then removed the nucleus, the fertilized nucleus of an egg, frog egg, and then replaced that with the nucleus of the tumor cell. So everything was the same. The cytoplasm was normal, but now the nucleus of the tumor was placed into the cytoplasm of the fertilized egg to see what would happen. And what he found was that this nucleus of the tumor cell formed a perfectly normal tadpole. Tadpoles can regenerate their tail. So he cut the tail off the tadpole, and it regenerated a perfectly normal tail. And this is all together with the nucleus from the raging kidney tumor. Interestingly enough, the tadpole could never develop into a mature adult frog.
Oh.
So there was some genetic abnormality in the nucleus of the tumor cell that aborted development but did not cause dysregulated cell growth.
Right, so there was DNA damage. Was there actually in that material inside the nucleus, but it wasn't causing that dysregulation of growth? Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Wow.
And then Rudy Janisch went on, and he did the same thing in mice. He transplanted nuclei from melanoma, skin cancer cells, and pancreatic cancer's nuclei into the stem cells of the mouse. And of course, the procedures are a lot more sophisticated than with the frog. But he was able to show in no uncertain terms that mouse embryos could be developed to a certain stage of development with no dysregulated growth, but then they, like the frog, would abort. And he found out that how much DNA damage in the nucleus was the determining factor as to how far in development the frog or the mouse would grow or would develop. So nuclei that had few chromosomal abnormalities were allowed from a cancer nucleus with fewer chromosomal abnormalities could persist longer in development than mice cloned from the nuclei of cancer cells with massive rearrangements of the genetic material. Those guys would abort earlier in development. And Jim Morgan's group at St. Jude's in Memphis, Tennessee, showed the same thing. He was cloning mice from the nuclei of brain tumors.
Wow.
And again, they would go no dysregulated. Everything was quite in order. But then they would reach some bottleneck and the whole system would implode or abort. So clearly there was the genetic abnormalities in the nucleus were not leading to dysregulated growth, but disruption of development.
Right.
So clearly these findings show that it's not the mutations in the nucleus that are leading to dysregulated growth. It's something in the cytoplasm. And then that was clearly shown with the transplantation of mitochondria from one cell to the other. And you could completely shut down the oncogenic profile, the dysregulated growth, by putting new mitochondria in there.
Oh.
So these groups of experiments in total, you can't look at any one by itself.
Right.
You have to look at
it. Right, so you could do it the other.
Yeah.
Right, so you could you take the nucleus from a healthy cell and stick it inside a cancer cell and see what happens with that?
Israel and Schaefer did those beautiful experiments up at the University of Vermont. Mm-hmm. So they took cancer cells in vitro. These cells, when you put them into the flank of a rat, they form big tumors. So what he did is he took the nucleus from cells in culture that didn't form tumors when you put them into the rat. So they were considered non-tumorigenic. And he put that normal nucleus into the cytoplasm of the aggressive tumor and put them into the rat and got big tumors despite the normal nucleus present. And he did the reverse experiments again. You know, when you put the cancer nucleus into the normal cytoplasm, you got regulated growth, and when you put the normal cell into the cancer site, you get dysregulated growth. So it was clearly related to the mitochondria in the cytoplasm, not the condition of the nucleus. So you do all of those experiments over and over again, repeat them by different investigators in different laboratories using different tumor systems, and you come to the same general conclusion. The origin of dysregulated growth comes from the cytoplasm and not from the nucleus. And when we look at the cytoplasm in greater detail, we find abnormalities in the number, structure, and function of the mitochondria. So what I did is I went back and I looked at every major human cancer. And you have to go and look under electron microscopy, because unlike the nucleus, the mitochondria is a very tiny network, and you can't really see them clearly under light microscopy. So I had to go back in the 1960s and 70s and 80s and look at those studies on cancer that were done by electron microscopy. And then you look at the mitochondria, and in every major cancer, you can clearly see the organelle is all abnormal in structure and function. And in biology, a primary tenet of the field is that structure determines function. And when the structure of the organelle that's necessary for energy generation through oxidative phosphorylation is dysfunctional, when the structure of that organelle is abnormal, the function and getting energy is going to be abnormal. And in order for the cell to survive, it's going to have to ferment because it cannot use respiration. So the evidence is so strikingly clear that no cancer cell that we have found has a normal content or composition of the mitochondria. Mm. And knowing that, we then interrogated these cancer cells more intensely to see if there was any fuel that could substitute for glucose and glutamine. And that's when we came to the glutamine realization that cancer cells are fermenting an amino acid called glutamine more than any other amino acid. So it's a sugar and an amino acid that are driving all major cancers. Oh. And as long as the cancer cell, regardless if it's a lung, colon, bladder, breast, as long as it has access to glucose and glutamine, it can survive under all kinds of toxic treatments. But as soon as you pull the plug or interrupt the two pathways using glucose and glutamine, these tumor cells can't survive.
Right.
And they can't switch to fatty acids and ketone bodies because you need a good mitochondria to burn fatty acids and ketone bodies. The solution to the cancer problem is not that complicated. You bring people into a state of nutritional ketosis where you lower blood sugar as much as possible and transition the entire body over to ketones, which the tumor cells can't use. And then you use drugs to target the glutamine. And you can take away the glucose and the glutamine, and you will see these tumors melt away.
Wow.
They can't survive, and you don't have the toxicity to the rest of the body. The problem is what I just told you cannot be accepted or understood by the vast majority of people working in the oncology field.
Yeah, we'll come to that. That blindness is incredible, and I've heard you talk about that before. Absolutely astonishing and tragic, indeed, that you know there seems to be an unwillingness even to consider this and look into this. Can I just go back to this glutamine? So the glutamine was an addition that you have made to Warburg's theory, which presumably was just to do with glucose, wasn't it? He wasn't talking about glutamine, is that right?
That's correct. The pathway that was not known at the time of Warburg. Mm. There were several issues by which Warburg was displaced in his ideas. One was the fact that he used oxygen consumption as a marker for the fidelity of oxidative phosphorylation. And we now know that's not true in the cancer cell. It's true in the normal cell, but not the cancer cell. Cancer cells will consume oxygen, but the problem is it's not linked to efficient ATP synthesis through oxidative phosphorylation, unlike the normal cell. He knew nothing about the glutaminolysis pathway as the second fermentation pathway. So we showed cancer cells can live in the absence of oxygen in glutamine. So they can survive for some time in the glutamine. It's being fermented. It's not being respired. That's another major misunderstanding in the cancer field. They think glutamine is respired, not fermented. No, glutamine is fermented through the glutaminolysis pathway. That's our major new contribution to the cancer field. Yeah. We have a second fuel, an amino acid that can be fermented, and it is glutamine. And we interrogated every other amino acid. Nothing comes close to what glutamine can do to drive the metabolism of the cancer cell.
Okay.
And then the other thing is that Warburg was counting the production of lactic acid as a marker for energy in the cytoplasmic glycolysis pathway. And we now know that that's also not an accurate marker. because there's another, cancer cells have this second form of enzyme called pyruvate kinase M2, which makes lactic acid without producing ATP. So Warburg was driven by quantification to try to prove his point that cancer was a mitochondrial metabolic disease. But the readouts, his quantitative readouts, were an error. Not complete error, but he knew nothing about glutamine fermentation. He thought oxygen consumption was linked to ATP synthesis through OxPhos. That's incorrect because he didn't have some of the evidence we have today. And he was using lactic acid as a readout for ATP synthesis through the cytoplasm. And we know that that can happen for sure, but not as quantitative as what Warburg had thought. So we're putting together the whole field, why he was attacked, the misunderstanding from those who thought he was wrong. And we're going to clean the whole mess up and bring Warburg's idea back on track, but also move it forward, because he was always considered, they called it the Warburg hypothesis, because many other folks said, oh, cancer cells can consume oxygen just as readily as normal cells. The problem is they grouped all kinds of mouse, human, and rat tissues together. They didn't separate them based on species. So you get a lot of misinformation from that. So we can clear up most of the misunderstanding and mistakes made and bring the entire cancer field back on its rightful track, which is that it's a mitochondrial metabolic disorder driven by fermentation metabolism, and you can manage the disease quite readily by simultaneously targeting fermentation while the body is in a state of nutritional or therapeutic ketosis.
Okay.
We have seen this happen over and over again for humans and dogs, and this will be the future. This is the way you manage the disease. And we don't like to call it cure. We like to call it a management. How long can you keep someone alive? Does that mean the tumor goes away? No. Pablo Kelly in England, from Devon, England, is alive today after 9 years with a glioblastoma. His tumor is still there, but it's indolent. It's not growing wildly. So he's learned to live with it. Is he cured? No. Did he live far, far longer than he would have if he had standard of care, radiation? And he's 9 years out. I mean, what's wrong?
Well, the prognosis for that is really bad, isn't it? That's very aggressive, isn't it? People don't live very long at all with that.
Oh, yeah. You can see people die with usually under 2 years, 15 months. And the older you are, you're dead sometimes before a year, 9 to 10,
right.
12 months.
Okay. Did he contact you? Was it through your suggestion?
He contacted me. Contacted me. I didn't write the paper up for a long time because I thought he was going to be dead. He contacted me, said, I heard about this metabolic stuff. And then he said, he has a very interesting story. You should interview him on your program. You'd get a real kick out of it. He can give you the nitty gritty details of what they grabbed him. They hacked off his beard. They put a big cage on his head, ready to irradiate the guy. And he said, I don't want any of this. He just came in for a consultation. But in any event, he rejected all radiation and chemo.
I'll just say that. I'm sure I heard you say that the radiotherapy itself can actually give rise to a preponderance of glucose, which is even more problematic. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely correct.
Good heavens.
I know. And you know, the tragic loss of people with glioblastoma is created in large part by how we treat the patient. You're 100% correct. As soon as they finish the debulking surgery, they go in with radiation. And you can take a normal person and just irradiate any part of their body, and blood sugar goes flying up really high because of the stress.
Right.
And not only that, when you irradiate somebody's brain, the head gets hot, the tissue gets hot and starts to swell. So they give these poor patients high dose of dexamethasone, it's a steroid, which causes the blood sugar to go up into the range of a diabetic. And not only that, when you irradiate, you break apart these very tightly controlled glutamine-glutamate cycle in the brain. It's part of the way our nerves communicate with each other. So you free up massive amounts of glutamine in the microenvironment, and then you give all the steroids and you give massive doses of glucose. Wow. So the two fuels that drive the dysregulated growth are made in a great abundance by the very treatments that we're giving to these patients. And if you look at the survival statistics across all major medical schools throughout the world, almost everybody is dead within 2 years. You rarely get long-term survivors. And we've made no major progress in brain cancer management for 100 years. Can you believe this?
Wow.
And even though I publish the details, I publish open access papers showing exactly why all these patients are dying so fast. The field ignores it. They say glucose has nothing to do with the dysregulated growth.
Gosh.
They never heard of glutamine. And so you say to yourself, I feel it's so bad seeing these people slaughtered by the system. I mean, it's just terrible.
So your reservations about radiotherapy, does that just apply to brain cancers or is that generally in cancer?
Well, I would certainly limit it right now to brain cancer.
Okay.
But you have to realize anytime you irradiate your body, you're going to raise blood sugar, which isn't good. I think we've seen some level of success when patients are in nutritional ketosis, where the body is now burning ketones. Mm. And then if you have a localized lesion where a radiation bolt could cure it or eliminate it completely, you know, there's certainly that has to be taken under consideration. If you can be assured that the radiotherapy for a localized mass, and that's where it is, you can certainly improve the outcome by irradiating that person when they're in a state of nutritional ketosis, for sure.
Right.
For metastatic cancer, where the cells have spread and you're using radiation as kind of a whack-a-mole, I would not recommend it in those cases, especially if we pull the plug on the glucose and glutamine, we can get rid of most of this anyway. So why are we using radiation in the first place?
Right. So you call it a press pulse protocol or approach. So, yeah. So you're not suggesting that as an alternative to all these other ways of dealing with cancer, but it's another tool in the toolbox. You've got your chemotherapy, you've got your radiotherapy, you are using the press pulse, and that's sort of clearing the way for a more targeted use of these other therapies. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's true. In other words, a hybrid system.
Yeah.
And we've seen some really good success if you can reduce half or by three quarters the amount of chemotherapy. Mm. If the patient is in a state of nutritional ketosis, that chemotherapy can actually be very effective and actually works a little bit better and reduces a lot of the side adverse effects from that. We published a paper on a woman with breast cancer who was given 1 month to live, and she flew from Cleveland, Ohio, to Istanbul, Turkey, where some of our colleagues are working over there. She almost died on the trip, and she was in the emergency room for 2.5 weeks, and they gradually lowered her blood sugar. They gave her a very low dose of chemo while she was in a kind of a ketotic state, and gradually she started to turn around. Mm. And she had cancer in her brain, bones, stage four, that's why they gave her so little time to live. And then within a year and a half, she was, they couldn't find any lesions. And we got a picture of her in Hawaii with a husband enjoying a honeymoon or something, And people say, oh, that's a fluke. Well, Pablo Kelly is a fluke, you know. And we have another Greek guy who had metastatic lung cancer to the brain, Athanasos. He's out 9.5 years. We published that case report. And people say to us, oh, well, you're only publishing one at a time, you know, one of this. Are you kidding me? I mean, can you imagine if we were able to do this at a larger scale, the outcome you'd get? I mean, but there's so much resistance because they think cancer is a genetic disease. And as long as your brain is infestated with the wrong idea, you're going to continue to do stupid things.
Right. I've got a lot of questions to ask about that sort of institutional approach to things. Could you describe to us a little bit more about this press pulse protocol or approach? I mean, I can understand great idea to reduce glucose, reduce sugar intake, ketogenic diets, etc. Okay, so the cancer cell requires the glucose, but our normal cells can survive with ketones, etc. So it seems like a good strategy to do that. But of course, the glutamine is something that we cannot do without. So you can't just cut that out. So you've got to do it in this sort of pulsed way. So how does that all work?
Yeah, well, I took that idea, the press pulse concept, from Aaronson West. They were paleobiologists studying the history of life on Earth. And they had, in the past, they had these extreme exterminations of organisms on the planet. It never happened with one event. It always happened together with another event. So you had a stress, maybe a climate or a nutritional stress on a large number of organisms and populations. But there were survivors. But it's only happened when you have a calamitous volcanic or a meteor strike, when you have a climate stress, that you get complete extermination of species. So there's always some survivors under one or the other, but there's no survivors under both.
Uh-huh.
So I used that concept and said that, well, if we know that cancer cells cannot survive without glucose and glutamine, is it a way we can take that paleobiological concept and move it into the cancer field?
Mm.
So we realized that you can lower blood sugars in a patient to almost very, very low conditions from physiological studies in humans. We know we can get them down really, really low. So we said, well, we can press glucose down.
That's through fasting, isn't it? Is that right?
Through fasting and also ketone supplementation as well. So you can do water-only fasting, ketone supplementation, and you'll push blood sugars down really low. And then what happens, the brain is the greatest demand for glucose. So it starts consuming more glucose, but it can transition to ketone bodies as well. But the tumor cells are absolutely dependent on this glucose. So now for the first time, the tumor cells are under direct competition for a valuable metabolite with their own normal cells. Mm-hmm. When you have so much glucose in the blood, the brain has everything it needs. All the other organs has everything they need. And there's no pressure on the tumor cell. Mm-hmm. So the tumor cell has all the fuel that it needs. It's only when you lower that blood sugar, the brain now can transition, all organs can transition over to ketones. But the tumor cells are marginalized. They must have the sugar.
Right.
They're now in a direct competition with the normal cells of the body, and the tumor cells start to lose. But you're right about the glutamine. So the glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in our body. It's absolutely essential for the gut, the health of our gut, our immune system, the urea cycle. So you can't go in like a bull in a china shop and go after the glutamine. That's why we decided to use the pulse strategy, where we can target glutamine for a short period of time, which selectively will kill tumor cells, and then pull it off and let our immune cells recover. And they can come in and pick up the dead tumor cells, the corpses, because once you slaughter a whole bunch of cells, you're left with a bunch of dead cells in the microenvironment. And our immune cells, macrophages and such, go into the microenvironment and phagocytize the dead cells and clean up the mess. Mm. They need glutamine too. So you can't constantly press. This is the key, Julian. You must know biology. Mm. You must know systems physiology. You must understand these processes. Otherwise, what I'm saying makes absolutely no sense to anybody.
Okay.
You really have to understand biology, and you know how to play one cell, a group of cells off of another group of cells. You know how evolution works, so you can exploit that in knowing how cells evolve and what they need to do. So once you put all that together, you know, killing tumor cells is not, for us, it's quite logical. And the problem is you can't get the medical community to know what the hell I'm talking about.
So when you pulse in this way, you use substances in order to actually suppress the glutamine getting into the cancer cells.
Yes, is that right?
I think you mentioned something called DON. I don't know whether you still use that, because looking at Jane McClellan's book, I think she says something like, you used to have that approach, but it was a little bit too vigorous. Is that right?
Do you
use something different?
No, DON works beautifully, especially when you're in ketosis. Hmm? The reason why it was toxic is people weren't targeting glucose, and you were dumping large amounts of DON on the cancer patient, damaging his gut, damaging the immune system, killing some cancer cells. But again, you have to know the biology of what you're dealing with.
Right.
So you don't press DON, you pulse it.
Okay.
And the toxicity goes way, way down. This is the amazing thing. And we showed that the ketogenic diet facilitates delivery of DON to the target.
Hmm.
Right through the blood-brain barrier and other places as well.
Wow.
Again, you must understand biology if you want to successfully manage cancer.
Okay.
And unfortunately, the cancer field has no clue about most of what I just said.
Right. Yeah, I have, coming from a musical background, I have the picture of the conductor at the front of the orchestra, and it has to know exactly which instrument is about to play. And if you don't know, it's going to be a cacophony.
Well put.
This one called DON here, just so people know what it is. Is this right? Here we go. 6-diazo-5-oxo-L-norleucine. Is that it?
Yes, that's it. I'm surprised. Yeah, they did a very good job. Excellent. Should put you in the cancer clinic. I think you'd have more success than most of the folks working there. But
I looked it up and I thought, I've got to say what it is. Otherwise, people will wonder what DON means. Do you put somebody working at a university into your body? But there we are.
No, that's true. You know what it is? It's a molecule that looks very, very similar to glutamine. And the body, looks at it as the cells look at it as if it were glutamine. So the cancer cells suck it up, but the key enzyme that metabolizes glutamine to glutamate, which is a glutaminase, gets paralyzed. Mm. So the DON paralyzes one of the key pathways in the glutaminolysis pathway, depriving the cell of energy through glutamine fermentation.
Yeah.
So essentially, you've shut down the glutaminolysis pathway with DON. and you're shutting down the glycolysis pathway with very restricted glucose. Mm-hmm. So you're taking the two pathways that are essential. They're what we call necessary and essential for the dysregulated growth of the tumor cell, and you're simultaneously shutting those two pathways down, using DON to shut down glutamine. And people always say, oh, what can I eat to reduce? Nothing. Yeah. Julian, you must tell people there is no diet that will restrict glutamine.
Okay.
The only way you can get a little glutamine down, we found George Cahill down at Joslin Diabetes when he was alive back in the 60s and 70s. He fasted people for at least 21 days. And that brought glutamine down, but it didn't eliminate glutamine. Mm. So you can do that with glucose goes down, glutamine goes down. But if you really want to get rid of all the glutamine, you got to use a little bit of a drug and you have to pulse it so people stay healthy and you pull it off. So you pulse, you press, you pulse, and you can gradually, we're trying to, and most of these folks that have cancer, they have high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, hypertension, they got a whole slug of things. And you manage all of these things together. Like Guy Tannenbaum, he had advanced prostate cancer to the bone. He went on several 18-day water-only fastings, and he lost a lot of weight. He got rid of his type 2 diabetes. Prostate cancer is managed. Can't find it anywhere. Hypertension, high blood pressure. And all of those things went away along with the prostate cancer.
That's incredible.
So that's why some people say this procedure, metabolic therapy, is what we call a disruptive technology.
Right. Yeah. It's incredible stuff. It really is. And you brought up there prostate cancer. So can this general approach be used for all cancers or any particular ones?
As I said, when I went through the entire literature looking for any kind of a cancer that would have a normal mitochondria that would not respond then to metabolic therapy, we couldn't find any. And this is what Warburg said. Warburg said that cancer is a disease of the mitochondria, disorder of the mitochondria. Every cancer that he looked at, every cancer that I've looked at, have abnormal mitochondria structure and function. That means they must ferment. Mm-hmm. So the strategy should work very well against all cancers. Mm. And as I said, we haven't found any that doesn't respond at all. And we have lung cancer, colon cancer, bladder cancer, breast cancer, brain cancer, colorectal cancer. They're all the same. They all have the same problem. They can't live without fermentation. Mm-hmm. This is another disruptive technology. And what I just said,
are there any danger?
People can't believe it. They can't believe it.
I mean, it's all very exciting, but I just wonder, some people might be thinking, well, maybe there are some dangers to this kind of approach. I mean, people associate drastic weight loss sometimes with having a cancer. So, if you're going through some process where you're not eating normal foods, and you're dieting excessively and fasting, you're going to get great weight loss. Could that be really dangerous?
Well, there's two types of weight loss. We have pathological weight loss and we have therapeutic weight loss. Mm. Totally different kinds of things. So when you have pathological weight loss, if you are a healthy guy and someone gives you poison, you get diarrhea, vomiting, fatigue, you lose weight because you're poisoned. Mm. But most people who are poisoned don't go out and eat a lot. So they lose weight because they've been poisoned, right? Mm. That's called pathological weight loss. And then you can have cachexia, which is a factor where the cancer cells themselves will send signals to the muscle, and the muscle starts to break down, feeding amino acids, either converted to glucose or glutamine itself goes right to the cancer cell. So the tumor cells are eliciting a wasting syndrome called cachexia. Those are called pathological states, both the cachectic state and the poison state. People will lose body weight because of the pathology associated with those phenomena. Therapeutic weight loss is you stop eating, but your mitochondria get super healthy and they become much more energy efficient. At first, a cancer patient may lose weight, but you have a combination of pathological and therapeutic weight loss overlapped on top of each other. As the cancer cells gradually get destroyed and reabsorbed into the body, the patient begins to eat again and puts on normal weight as the cancer cells are eliminated. Yeah. So again, it's understanding the physiology and biology of the entire body and system to separate pathological weight loss from cancer. And you go to the oncology centers, the physicians say, eat as much sugar and cake as you possibly can to gain weight, to keep weight on. I mean, this is nuts. This is like throwing gasoline on the fire. I mean, when you have folks that are, I know it's tragic. No. I don't want to even laugh about
it. It's the irony of it, isn't it? Yes, indeed. It is tragic.
It's the irony. Yeah. It's so ironic that the very folks that you entrust your dear soul and existence to are clueless on the biology of the disease they're treating. And it's clear why cancer is now ready to replace cardiovascular disease as the number one killer in Western societies. It becomes entirely clear why all this is happening.
I see.
Because the folks that are supposed to know don't know.
Well, it's amazing, actually. There's the irony, just walking into the hospital and you want to have something to eat and you find it's not that easy to get a salad. It's much easier to get a a bag of chips or something.
This is
supposed to be a hospital. What's going on here? I know it's all to do with the business side of things, of course, but it is tragic.
Well, I think it's lack of knowledge. I think once the oncologists are trained and learned in medical school about how to use diet and nutrition as a weapon to manage cancer and know how to work certain drugs and procedures off of each other, then this whole cancer thing will be under control. We can worry about other things, maybe dementia, because there's no therapy on the horizon like we have on cancer. Cancer has a very bright end of the tunnel. We're very hopeful. The only things impeding what I'm saying is the resistance to change and the lack of knowledge, and maybe also revenue generation, because you can't come into a system where they're generating millions and millions of dollars in the academic and the pharmaceutical industries and then, have them completely change shop overnight. Mm. So that's why I think we have a hybrid system that will keep everybody employed for a while, doing what they do in a different kind of a context, seeing rather remarkable and spectacular results on some folks. And then they'll gradually slowly drift to the point where metabolic therapy becomes the primary treatment modality for these patients, but it'll take time.
So is it right that a lot of cancer research is focused on finding this gene and that gene that supposedly is responsible for producing whatever a cancer it is, and that's where a lot of the funding is going? Is that right?
Oh yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. Immunotherapy is the hot thing now. Immunotherapy.
Yeah.
That's where you give patients these PD-L1, PD-1, CAR-T immunotherapy. You're trying to use your immune system to kill the tumor cells. You got to realize the metastatic cell is already part of our immune system. It's a hybrid macrophage of a dysregulated growing macrophage. And it fires out and kills some of these immune cells. But what you're trying to do, you're trying to look for markers on the surface of the tumor cell. So then you can train an immune cell to go after that tumor cell marker and kill the tumor cell at a high cost. The problem with some of those immune therapies, yes, there are some folks that do really, really well. There's a lot of folks who don't get any better. And then there's about 15 to 18% of them that have hyperprogressive disease, where the immunotherapy will accelerate the growth of the tumor cell. And not only that, it'll attack liver and kidneys, and you get off-target effects from a targeted therapy with off-target effects. So some folks die twice as fast with the immunotherapy, because it's based on the somatic mutation theory. Immunotherapy is based on the somatic mutation theory of cancer. If the somatic mutation theory of cancer, the outcome will never be optimal.
Right.
You're never going to have an optimal outcome when you're treating a disease based on an incorrect theory, period.
It's so tragic, isn't it? Because that fits with the whole individualized medicine, which in many ways sounds like a great idea. Yeah. But if that's sort of twisted by this wrong way, the wrong paradigm, then a great idea can actually become a barrier to the best idea.
No, you're 100% correct. I mean, you're running into these are the kinds of extenuating circumstances that prevent change in the right direction. Mm. I don't know the English UK government, but the American government spent billions of dollars on the Cancer Genome Atlas, looking at every kind of a mutation in every kind of a cell for billions of dollars. And we have all of this stuff, and it drives an entire field looking for mutations and all this. Yeah. And it's all downstream effects. And it's like you've invested so much and you expect an outcome to be comparable to the investment, and you're not getting it at all, mainly because the original theory was incorrect. It wasn't the correct theory. That's the tragedy.
Yeah, it is. It's like a massive machine that self-perpetuates. How do you turn that around? Mixed metaphors there. I'm thinking of the massive liner on the ocean, and it's got a massive momentum. How do you turn that around? I mean, you can talk about it like this, and it's great to hear what you say, etc. Are oncologists taking on board what you say? Is there sort of grassroots support that can change this over time?
Well, you know what I find is the most interesting thing. Many of the people who read my work and think about it carefully email me and they say, I know you're 100% correct. I've been thinking about that for a long time. But most of these guys are now retired. They're no longer in the system. And now for the first time, they're thinking about things and putting it into the context of their life experiences and knew all along that I'm right. The whole concept of cancer is a metabolic disease. But when they're in the trenches, working day to day to handle mobs of cancer people and never being trained to understand what I'm saying. You know, it's just a continuation of a tragic situation. Until the medical schools can start training oncologists to understand that cancer is not a genetic disease, it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease, and diet and drug combinations are very, very powerful in managing cancer without toxicity, then and we keep publishing papers like Pablo Kelly. Like I told you, I didn't want to publish Pablo because, you know, if he died at 3 or 4 years, people say, well, that's a normal course of action. Yeah. The guy's out 9 years now. And I said to him, I said, well, we're going to write him up. And we wrote up a couple of other people that are out far, far longer than you would ever expect it. So we keep doing that. And believe me, people are smart. They look around and they say, geez, I want that. Can you give me? When they start stampeding into the oncologist, I want metabolic therapy. Then they're going to change. They have to change.
Well, I'm going to go to the next question here by saying exactly that. I want that. I mean, I don't actually have a diagnosis of cancer, you know, thankfully. But if somebody like me, I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, I'm going to reduce sugar. I'm going to reduce the highly processed carbohydrates. Would that be a good thing to do? Not for prevention, etc., because you're not necessarily going to be able to prevent something from happening necessarily. Yeah. But perhaps for reducing your risk of developing such a thing, would that be a good idea? Does that make sense?
Oh, makes perfect sense. Because you can't get cancer if your mitochondria remain healthy. Because cancer starts with chronic damage to the oxidative phosphorylation system in the mitochondria. So as long as that OxPhos system is working, it's very difficult to get cancer. So the question is, how do you keep your OxPhos healthy? Well, you, as you just said, we try to avoid risk factors. You know, no exercise, big risk factor, lack of exercise, regular exercise, smoking, which is now being replaced by obesity, is replacing smoking as a risk factor. Don't just eat highly processed foods. Restrict calories, walk, so you can keep your mitochondria healthy without dropping out of society completely. You know, we just reduce the provocative agents that would damage oxidative phosphorylation. And as I said, the body is, if given the opportunity, it will heal. So even though we have damaged our mitochondria through various risk factors, if we can avoid them for a while, give our mitochondria a chance to regain, because the process of autophagy is self-digestion of mitochondria.
Yeah.
So water-only fasting allows ineffective mitochondria, partially effective mitochondria, being digested inside the cell.
Right.
And what you're left with is highly functioning mitochondria. So intermittent fasting, like skipping meals periodically or going 18 to 20 hours without eating, these kinds of things, give the body a chance to heal. And mitochondria can remain functional for a longer period of time. Thereby, you reduce risk. You don't absolutely eliminate the probability of getting cancer, but you significantly reduce risk. So prevention can be done. Most people discount prevention. Obviously, we have an obesity epidemic. If people were really concerned about cancer, there would not be an obesity epidemic because it replaces smoking as a risk factor. So clearly, as long as people know, then they can make a choice as to what to do. But even if they choose not to do any preventative measures and they do get a dysregulated neoplastic growth, we have a solution, a non-toxic strategy. They're going to eventually have to go into the water-only fasting anyway because it makes the whole system work better. The pulse therapies work better when you're in a state of nutritional ketosis. But, you know, people are more willing to do the restrictions and the approaches when the angel of death is looking over your shoulder. You'd be surprised how motivated some people become.
Right. Indeed. Yes. But I do find this notion of the therapeutic ketosis very attractive and exciting. But I do wonder, you know, how easy is it to get into that state? I mean, I assume that most people walking around in UK, US, places like that, don't generally have a great glucose ketone balance. So, I mean, how easy is it to get a great balance so that you actually have a therapeutic condition going on?
Yeah, well, it's not easy. But we've tried to take... Oh, no. I mean, the Japanese and the Chinese don't want any part of it either, nor do the Koreans. So it's not just English in the United States.
No, sure.
The Germans don't want any part of it. Italians, I mean, you go around the world, you see what the guys are eating. Nobody wants to give up the rice, the pasta, the potatoes, you know, the bread. Oh, I got a lot of bread. You know, but the issue here is for cancer patients, because, you know, we're not out trying to tell folks down at the pub to, you know, stop eating the chips. But the guy who has the cancer is the guy that would be more motivated to do this. Mm. It's easy to tell somebody to stop eating, but it's hard to do it. And I've tried it. It's brutal. It's a bitch. As I said, you know, I went 3 days without eating anything. This company made these ketogenic muffins. I tasted one before I went on the fast. I said, you wouldn't give this muffin to the dog. It's so bad. So
you know, they sound like contradictions in terms. Yes.
Yeah. But then I went on 3 days of water fasting and I broke my fast eating this. It was the best damn muffin I ever ate in my life. And I got crumbs all over the place. I was shaking while I was eating the muffin.
Yeah, it's all about perspective, isn't it? Absolutely.
Absolutely all about perspective.
Yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? If you do actually cut down the, you know, the number of carbohydrates that you eat and you eat more good fats, etc., it is actually easier then to transition on to fasting, isn't it, after that, rather than going straight in.
And, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what we decided. We work with some clinicians and nutritionists. So what we do is the patient is told to eat whatever they want, as long as they can bring their glucose ketone index down to 2.0 or below. So if they are a plant eater or a carnivore or vegetarian or whatever you want, a pescatarian, Mediterranean, and people say, can I eat this? Can I eat that? I say, I don't know. What is it doing to your GKI? And when they look at the GKI, they say, oh my, I can't barely eat anything. I said, now you've come to know.
Okay. Oh, so hold on. What were the glucose ketone index then? What is this balance then?
Yeah, well, so
how does one relate to the other? What's the ratio?
The ratio is about 2. So it's the ratio of glucose in millimolar to ketone, basically beta hydroxybutyrate in millimolar in the blood. And most folks eating a Western diet will be up at around 50 or 60. And you want to bring that number down to 2.0 or preferably below 1.
So is that a ratio of 50 to 1, do you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that means you have much more glucose than ketone in your blood. Wow. If you're eating carbohydrates and things. Yeah, it's amazing. Mm. So you can bring it down. Like, for example, if you eat carnivore, just meat, forget about the potatoes, the bread and whatever. You can bring that GKI down really good. Plants are a little harder because there's a little bit more carbohydrate in some of the plants than there is in meat. But, you know, vegans can bring, vegetarians can bring it down but they realize they have to eat a lot less. But it's the shock of you don't have to go cold turkey on food. You can gradually transition away. Mm. And then once the patient hits the GKI lower levels, that's when we start the drugs, the DON and some of the other drugs. Yeah. And then they can jump to water-only fasting. The jump is not so dramatic anymore, like you went with cold turkey. It's like jumping off the side of a building rather than taking the stairs. You know, so you gradually bring your body into a new state. And it's not so traumatic when you do that last, my body has already transitioned over to ketones, so now I can just drink water. And then when the drugs come in, man, they just hammer the hell out of those tumor cells. Mm-hmm. These tumor cells don't know what hit them, put it that way. They're struggling for their own existence. They say, what the hell is going on here? I was looking for that jelly donut or that pork pie. It wasn't not coming anymore.
Oh, dear. This is very, very exciting stuff indeed. And it, as you say, it is so tragic that this is not taken seriously by the establishment. So how easy is it to monitor your own GKI? Is there some sort of device for that?
Yeah, well, there's
the Keto
Mojo. You can buy these on Amazon. Dorian Greenow built the Keto Mojo. I wanted to patent the glucose ketone index, but we can't patent a formula. So I said, oh, wow. So the Keto Mojo group picked it up. And they put it into a ketone meter. So you can, from the same drop of blood, you measure your blood sugar on one strip and your ketones on a ketone strip, and you put it into the meter, and then you push the button, and it gives you the ratio of glucose to ketones. And that allows the cancer patient to know at what point they're in therapeutic ketosis. Mm-hmm. So it allows them to either take hyperbaric oxygen or glutamine inhibitors or further glucose inhibitors in low doses, very low doses. So there's no toxicity associated with any of these kinds of therapies. You don't need to have hair loss and nausea and vomiting and all this kind of crazy stuff. None of that stuff. Very, very rarely do you have anybody that experiences that unless they didn't do the procedure in the right order and in the correct way. And then you find people that come back and they say, oh, my doctor, I went there and the tumor that was spotted all over the place and I had this big thing is gone, or it's shrunk down by 3/4. And the doctors don't understand what happened. I said, they should know exactly what happened. What is wrong with these guys? They should know exactly what happened and the logic behind it. The cancer cell is dying because it can't get the fuel that it needs for a fermentation metabolism. Just that simple.
Well, on the surface, obviously there's a huge amount of biomedical information under the surface, but on the surface, yes, it just seems incredibly straightforward, you know? Certain types of cells need it and certain types of cells can do without it, etc. Yeah, but I mean, talking about oncologists in their retirement showing interest, etc., what about doctors who are actually dealing with patients and they find that there's an amazing remission that takes place and they can't understand it? Do they actually, serving GPs and practicing oncologists, etc., do they get in touch with you to say, can you explain what's going on here? Is it really that straightforward? Give us the lowdown on this. Do you get that?
Very rarely.
Right.
A lot of the physicians say, I don't really care what you're doing, but it seems to be working. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Oh.
And I say, aren't you interested in knowing why you're seeing what you see? They always call it a miracle or some unexplained. Oh, I've never seen anything like this. Well, for crying out loud, don't you want to know the mechanism of what? No. Just keep doing what you're doing. Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's like their brain is not allowed to open up to think anything different than what they were trained to do.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yes.
It's amazing. It's almost like an instant. Some of those neuropsychiatric guys must be able to figure this out. Something happens to the brain where it makes it incapable of knowing anything more than it was trained to know. nor do they want to know about it. So it's not all. I don't want to say oncologist is like this.
Of course.
But I would say that 9 out of 10 are.
Well, paradigms are very, very powerful. I don't think people realize quite how easily we can get caught up in that and be, you know, we can mean very well, think we're doing the right thing, but we just cannot think outside the box, as the expression goes. And it applies to lots of things, and it's quite incredible. Yeah.
What I was surprised about it, it's the same in all the major countries. Mm-hmm. I thought from India, they would be a little bit more flexible. No, they just irradiate people. I put them in China, Germans, the English, the Americans, Japanese, they all do the same thing. It's like, can't you guys think that this is not working? We have an epidemic. None of this. It's a worldwide paralysis of thinking.
Yeah.
All the oncology centers do the same thing.
Yeah. Are you freely able to research involving patients in any country, or are there more restrictions in some places than others? I'm wondering if countries are more enlightened than others. Or,
no, I haven't found one yet. So, they're always telling me we can have this clinic somewhere in Africa or something like this. But we try to get this in major hospitals, okay, which is this metabolic therapy. And what they say is, okay, we'll do standard of care, and then we'll do standard of care with metabolic therapy.
Yeah.
But we won't do metabolic therapy in the absence of standard of care. So what you have is a gaping missing control group, the experimental group, I should say, because God forbid, if metabolic therapy is much better than standard of care, and even better than standard of care with metabolic therapy and standard of care as a hybrid, and metabolic therapy by itself is so much superior. Oh, that would be, and you did a clinical trial on that. You, the whole field would overturn. I mean, you wouldn't be able to, and the cancer patients would stampede for metabolic therapy. They don't want radiation and chemo. I don't know anybody who really got upset by saying, you know, oh, I'm really upset. He told me I didn't need radiation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like they say, thank God I don't need radiation.
Absolutely.
So, so it's a worldwide phenomenon. And Peyton Rouse said the somatic mutation theory acts like a tranquilizer on the brain. And I absolutely believe that. I don't know what's going on. So it's just a matter of time, because more and more people are coming on the web, like Pablo Kelly.
Oh.
I mean, Pablo's a dead man. He should have been dead years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He's had two kids. He got married.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's just one. But I said, we have many others. I just don't have time to write them all up. You know, it's hard writing up case reports.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the basic research on the preclinical systems. I show it works. I mean, we have it covered on every different way, you know, and yet people don't want to know about it. I know. Julian, tell me, what's wrong with this picture?
you seem so amazingly positive, though. I mean, you've talked about all these barriers there are to these sort of ideas being accepted, and yet you seem incredibly, you know, you're laughing and you're chuckling and you're talking about this will be the future, etc. But how on earth is it going to be the future if there's such resistance? I'm not trying to pour cold water on this. I just wonder how.
Because people want to live. That's the motive. Yeah. People want to live.
Yeah.
And that's the motivation. And once they realize this, and it spreads like a grass fire, they're the consumers. Those are the folks. that are going to go into the oncology clinics and say, I want metabolic therapy. And if they say, well, you can't, I can't do that, well, I'm going somewhere where I can get it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
All of a sudden it'll change. This is why our target audience is predominantly cancer patients, because I can talk to my academic colleagues until I'm blue in the face, and you might as well be talking to a plug socket. They can't get away from the paradigm. But the people with cancer, and that's another thing too. I can't tell you how many physicians have called me for their wives or their loved one or themselves,
right,
wanting metabolic therapy.
Yeah.
You know,
that makes sense.
And I tell them what to do and how to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. You can't keep a good idea down forever, can you? Especially when it is desperately needed, when people are calling out for it. So, yeah, that does make sense.
I mean,
absolutely.
It took how long it took the Catholic Church to realize that the earth was no longer the center of the solar system.
That was a paradigm, if ever there was one.
They burned Bruno, the poor Bruno, Giordano Bruno, stripped naked and burned to death for saying that there might be life on another planet.
I mean, I'm so glad that's not true anymore, because I've said many times on this show, I think there's life on another planet. There we go.
He was unacceptable. You cannot think like that.
It's amazing how that sort of, and it's not the Catholic Church now, but it's amazing how that kind of approach, although not burning people at the stake, but nevertheless, there are modern equivalents of that for sure.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, absolutely. Mm. And we just have to work through the resistance. But I think, you know, the target audience here, I publish all my papers open access. You know, I don't have time to discuss the intricacies of what I'm saying at the molecular and biochemical level, because I think most of the folks would be turned off from that.
Absolutely.
But if they want that detail, all of our papers are published open access. All I have to do is put my name into Google and say Seafried Publications, and you'll get the details of the press pulse, the glucose ketone index papers, the strategies. Pablo Kelly is published there. Several other breast cancer and lung cancer patients are published there. So you can read the case reports, see what those folks did, why they're doing so well. And you can read those who really want to get into the metabolic mud and the details of the pathways. That's there, too. He didn't tell us about how to do this and who did that. Well, go read the papers. You get all the information. And then if you still have questions on a real depth level, I'll be happy to address something at a deeper level if people want to go that way.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you didn't go into as much detail as you could have done on this show, because I'd have had trouble catching up with you. It's very, very difficult to follow all of it, of course. But of course, it's really interesting to get this kind of surface view, which you have to get initially in order to get the idea of it. So I'm hugely grateful to you for coming on to share this and your enthusiasm and your vision and your experience of this. It really is fascinating. And so you talk about how easy it is, in fact, to get hold of the information that you have published. Is there one particular repository for that, or is it just a case of using a search engine to find these materials?
Just my name and publication.
Right.
Yeah, just go into Google, Thomas N. Seafried Publications, and you'll get most of what I've done. I make it a point to publish open access, so it's not behind a journal, a wall, a publication wall where people have to have a subscription. So they can get it free.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost anything. And then they can bring the paper down to their oncologist and say, oh, and we're also working on a really comprehensive treatment protocol with my associate, Dr. Thomas Duryea, who is an MD, PhD. And we're putting together with a number of other co-authors, physicians and scientists, a comprehensive treatment protocol for glioblastoma, how-to manual, so to speak. So anybody with a medical degree should be able to apply this to their patients. And then with a few tweaks, it will be applicable to almost all of the major cancers. So once we have that published, and we hope to put that on open access as well. So then any physician anywhere can. The only problem is that the system prevents them from doing it. It's not part of the standard of care. And right now in the United States, physicians could lose their license to practice if they were to choose something that wasn't sanctioned by the system.
Right.
So essentially it's the system itself.
Yeah.
That's preventing. And then they say, you know, there's no clinical trials. Well, who's going to run a clinical trial when you have nobody that knows how to do it? And who's going to pay for a clinical trial?
Absolutely.
Because usually pharmaceutical companies pay for this. There's millions of dollars. And because they're going to potentially profit from a drug that might keep someone alive for three extra weeks.
Yeah.
You know, so let's take a metabolic therapy, keep you alive for three or four extra years. But you can't make any, it's not a revenue generating process.
Yeah,
so those are the things.
Yeah, indeed. It's amazing how that story has cropped up in recent years so much. It's tragic on a number of levels. Yeah. Anyway, Professor Seyfried, thank you ever so much for coming on the show to discuss this. And thank you also for all your work over the years in such great depth. And it's very exciting to find that you're having great success with this. And thanks for continuing to draw attention on podcasts like this and speak to people like me. As I said at the beginning of the show, you know, I don't have that biological background. So thank you ever so much. And just before we go, I will say, as I always say, none of this is personal medical advice. Everybody is different. This is all for information purposes only. By all means, share it with your doctor, of course. But please do first consult your doctor before making any changes to your diet, lifestyle, or medication. So once again, Professor Seyfried, thank you ever so much for coming on. It's been a delight to speak to you. Enjoyed it very much, and I'm sure people will find it very exciting and interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julian. It was nice to be here.
Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajakoff. Attribution non-commercial share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Professor Thomas Seyfried, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.